Blog Talk Radio.
I gotta do a poll or something. Find out if it's acceptable that I enter to this music. I think the N-word is the most used word in the first, like, 30 seconds of that song. You PC, bro?
I gotta check in with PC, bro, see if that's all good. What's up, bitches? How's everybody's day going? I'm excited because I'm a loser, and tonight is a Republican debate. Which means a lot of laughing, but maybe a little bit of crying as well at the thought that one of these people might end up running the country. But that's later. Got a lot to get to before then. I think the undercard debate starts at 7, I think-ish, and 9 o'clock for the main one. I was fucking around earlier, like George Pataki is excited to even be allowed in the undercard debate. And somebody told me, actually, he's not even allowed in the undercard debate. Oh, there's some guy, I don't know why some people are still in there. Lindsey Graham, man. Bobby Jindal. What's the point? What the fuck is the point? Even now, it looks like Chris Christie, Mike Huckabee, even though I think they did good in the last debate, I think they were demoted from the main stage to the undercard stage, even after I think they beasted in the last debate. So, I don't know, man. It's getting weary. Ben Carson lies every 32 seconds, and now he's basically tied with Donald Trump nationally, which is a weird thing. But then again, I don't know how much, you know, we consider this, because there's that great Twitter account that Keith Olbermann referenced last week. It's the account that says what was going on in every election at this point. So in like 2004, Howard Dean was leading. In 2008, it was Hillary Clinton by like 20 points or some shit. Rudy Giuliani was leading in the Republican field in 2004. In 2008, it was Herman Cain. So, you know, maybe we don't need to be scared. But no matter what, whoever comes out of that Republican side, it's going to be a mess. Because at this point, it looks like it's not going to be Paul or Kasich, and they're probably the only two somewhat sane people. But let me tell you what we have to look forward to today. We have Reuters with a brutally honest column about Marco Rubio and what he's up to now that he's an establishment favorite. We also have Rubio face-planting in terms of his healthcare policy, because some people did a little bit of research here and found out that he basically was a big proponent of Obamacare before Obamacare, like every other Republican. And then later on, Carly Fiorina discusses her non-tax plan. You'll see why I'm calling it a non-tax plan when we get to that segment. We have people protesting for a living wage around the country. Those goddamn communists, somebody has to stop them. And Netanyahu and Obama meet and hold hands and caress each other's hair gently. And then Netanyahu swings a bat at his face. That's all metaphorically speaking, of course. I'll tell you how it bears out in reality, though, when we discuss it. Rush Limbaugh continues to be embarrassing, and Bill O'Reilly yells about black people, of course. So let's get started here, and I want to do that with Marco Rubio and his newfound celebrity, I guess you could say, among certain groups of people, that is. All right. Reuters has a brutally honest column out today on Marco Rubio's debate goals for tonight. So they say that he has two audiences. Quote, one will be the voters, whom the surging presidential candidate needs to do well in the early voting states, such as Iowa and New Hampshire. The other will be the deep-pocketed donors, some of whom have stayed on the sidelines as the Republican race has progressed, who Rubio needs to mount a large-scale national campaign. They say right now the establishment money guys are wondering, if not Bush, then who? Because of his relative youth, Cuban-American background, and telegenic appeal, Rubio, who's 44 years old, has long been viewed by pundits as perhaps the party's best hope to defeat the likely Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton. All right, so look at this. This is now a caricature of democracy. They're explaining in this article in Reuters, and they're not wrong. They're saying that the Republican establishment is basically picking the person who's younger and good-looking, and he's Cuban-American, so he's diverse in his background, and they're trying to ride this wave of, oh, we just had the first black president, now, you know, people are saying with Hillary Clinton that could be the first female president, so they're trying to, okay, we can get in on this too, we got a Cuban guy here, guys, pay attention, Cuban guy, you want him, and this is the way that the establishment is thinking, and their goal is to make him their token shill. They want to dump money into his campaign so that he'll do their bidding. And what I love about this piece is that this is, you know, Reuters, very mainstream, I guess you could say, in a way. And in the article, there's just this tone of it's a matter-of-fact way of speaking about it. Like, well, this is what the establishment is thinking. This is what the big money donors, the billionaires want to do, and here's why. Lacking from the piece, even though Reuters does a good job, oftentimes, the print outlets are much better than TV. What's lacking is this sense of, oh, wait, this isn't the way that a democracy is supposed to function. I'm waiting for, like, the passage where it's like, and you know, the founders are rolling over in their graves, and this is wrong. It's supposed to be one man, one vote. Now we have two primaries, the primary among the people, but also the primary among the moneyed interests. It never comes. It just, you know, for all kinds of reporters and journalists, it's just another day in America. It's a Tuesday. It's 11:30. What? I'm writing an article about how we don't have a democracy anymore. You want me to get angry about it and, like, put it into context and perspective and give history and let people know how this is screwing them over? No, I'll just talk about it in a matter-of-fact way. No, you should be outraged over this because this is the root cause of all the other problems that we have. You know, when you look at opinion polls for Congress, I mean, it varies depending on what time, of course, you're talking about, but typically you have an approval rating that goes anywhere from like 9% to 22%, that range there. And it's always in that range. How can that possibly be? In a democracy where we get to pick our leaders, we vote for the people, and then the day after you go look at the approval ratings, and it's like, you know, 18%. Well, wait, you all just literally voted for them, so how can it be that you don't like them? Now, the answer to that is people know on some level that, yeah, we're picking among all bad candidates. And the reason why they're all bad candidates is because you could tell them very clearly and very directly, as we have, hey, here are the priorities we want. This is what we're in favor of. We're going to vote for you. Can you go do this for us? And then they never do it. And the problem is exactly this. Because, you know, you're just a minor step in the process. Where it's like, okay, now I got to go out there and try to get the idiots to vote for me and be all cheery and say, hey, you want to vote for me, don't you? But the bigger thing is, well, I need the financial backing in order to stay in that position in the first place. It really is, you know, kind of like a Russian oligarchy system at this point. People make fun of Iran because the religious leaders get to pick the candidates and then you choose from among those candidates. We have the same thing here with the business interests, the oligarchy that gets to pick the candidates and then they prop them up and then you get to pick from among those candidates. So this is the problem. The problem is over 80% of the American people want to raise the minimum wage. Nobody's doing it. Republicans, Democrats. The problem is only 17% of the American people still want to be in Afghanistan. Both parties unanimously agree, let's stay in Afghanistan. And we can go down the list here. Over 90% want a universal background check for gun purchases. We haven't gotten that. You know, whenever there's a push for it, it's more of a whimper where the Democrats are like, oh, you said watered down background check bill. Oh, no, you don't want to do it? Okay, let me run and hide for 5 years now. So this is the problem, man. The problem is the politicians aren't representing you, and people aren't screaming from the rooftop about how deeply corrupt and rotten this system is. And again, I've always maintained on this show that the mainstream media outlets on TV are the worst of the worst. I mean, they just have no clue what they're doing, and it's pathetic to watch them. The print outlets are actually not bad. New York Times, Washington Post, many, many online outlets that are even better than them. Reuters does not do a horrible job. Associated Press is where we get all the information for our show. But it's at the point now where even though they're, like, covering the issue of money in politics, they just talk about it as if it's another step of the process and we should all be resigned to it. No, I'm not resigned to it. We shouldn't be resigned to it. We should get up and fight. And we've discussed it before, but it bears mentioning again, and I'm going to keep bringing it up until I'm blue in the face, but there's various movements to try to win on this front. There's Represent.us, which goes about it in one particular way. There's Move to Amend, Tom Hartman's group, that goes about it another way. There's Wolfpack, the one that I'm most closely affiliated with, which, of course, TYT is heavily involved with, where their goal is to get a very specific amendment to the Constitution, which says, let's get money out of politics and let's do clean elections, which then makes it so that the politicians are funded by our tax dollars, the public tax dollars, when they run for office. Therefore, who are they more likely to represent? Us. We gave them the money, and they're not allowed to take money from private interests. Right now, virtually all their money comes from private interests, so who the fuck are they going to represent? Right now, it's fundamentally anti-one man, one vote. Because if Sheldon Adelson gives Marco Rubio millions of dollars, as he does, because Sheldon Adelson's already with him, well, who's Marco Rubio more likely to represent? Sheldon Adelson, when he calls up and says, hey, stop all other casinos from being created and ban online gambling because I need to make all the money. I need a monopoly. Or is he going to listen to some grandma in Wyoming who says, I need my Medicare expanded and I need an increase in my Social Security payments because I can't pay the bills. I'm going to be kicked out in the street. Who's going to take priority there? Obviously the person who gave him all the money, even though morally speaking, the grandmother in Wyoming should take priority. So this is the place that we're at. If you haven't joined in the fight, you should join in the fight. Check out wolf-pac.com and see how you can help. We just did a fundraiser where we sold Secular Talk shirts, and half the money went to Wolfpack. The other half went to Lilith Penn, who does a bunch of work for me for nothing. We raised over $2,000 for Wolfpack, and that's because I believe in the message, and I think that this is the first step in trying to fix our democracy. If we don't actually win on this, then everything else is kabuki theater. Because, you know, you can have this fake debate where, you know, Democrats say, hey, I want to regulate Wall Street, and Republicans say, well, I don't. But when you look at all the details, the Republicans want anarcho-capitalism, in a sense, where there's no regulation of Wall Street, and they'll crash the economy. And the Democrats want regulation in name only, where we're still going to get the bad outcome, and the economy will crash. And that's because they're all paid by Wall Street. So this is a battle for the soul of our country. And you can join up and you can, you know, help out in terms of giving some donations. You can pay monthly, whatever it is, $10 a month, or you can actually get involved and call your state legislator and actually literally be boots on the ground in this fight, and you can take a leadership role. So it's up to you, but if you join in this fight, then there's no doubt that you're going to go down in history as somebody who's part of a very important movement, not unlike the women's suffrage movement, not unlike the civil rights movement, because this really is a fight to try to get our country back. Okay. Sticking with Marco Rubio, Marco Rubio has repeatedly promised to repeal Obamacare on the campaign trail. That's now a common Republican position that virtually all of the candidates have taken, and if I'm not mistaken, probably well over 95% of the Republican Party from when Obamacare passed until today have maintained that position. But the International Business Times did some digging into Rubio's past on this issue, and they found quite a bit of hypocrisy. So they report, quote, only a few years before he was elected to the U.S. Senate, Rubio was aggressively promoting some of the core policies of Obamacare. In 2006, Rubio released a book called 100 Innovative Ideas for Florida's Future. In the book section on healthcare, Rubio decried the fact that more than 3 million Floridians lack health insurance and may face barriers in accessing needed health services. As a solution, Rubio pressed to expand government-run healthcare programs and create an insurance exchange, both core tenets of Obamacare. All right, so they go on to explain in detail exactly what it is that Rubio supported expanding. So, for example, Florida Kid Care, which is one program, the Florida Health Insurance Plan, another one, Health Flex, community-based free clinics, which, by the way, is socialism, and other safety net programs as well, specifically when it comes to healthcare. So he says, hey, let's use our tax dollars to subsidize health insurance and health care for the poor in Florida, and then for everybody else, let's create a private health insurance exchange, like a marketplace. Not only is that similar to Obamacare, that is exactly what Obamacare is on a federal level. No, it's amazing. He's now Mitt Romney 2.0. Mitt Romney, who, of course, implemented a version of Obamacare at the state level when he was governor of Massachusetts, and then when he was running for president, he was like, oh, Obamacare's terrible. It's so bad. It's so wrong. It's so evil, which is why I did it in Massachusetts. Rubio was doing the same thing. He was advocating for it in Florida, and now that he's running in a Republican primary, he's like, health care. I'm against all versions of health care. The only kind of health care plan I have is praying to Jesus because I'm in a Republican primary right now and I need to be a barbarian. What? Did I say that out loud? God, these guys are such jokes. And understand, it's actually slightly unfair of me to single out Marco Rubio in this conversation because the reality is that virtually the entire Republican Party supported Obamacare before it was Obamacare. I don't know if you guys know this, but Richard Nixon was the first person to propose this kind of a health care reform system in America, where we subsidize for the poor, and then for everybody else, you have a private health insurance marketplace. Richard Nixon proposed that. Later on, Bob Dole proposed that. And then you had the Heritage Foundation in the early 1990s writing policy papers about this, saying that this is what they prefer as a right-wing alternative to socialized medicine, which the liberals are in favor of, the single-payer system. So, and you had people like Newt Gingrich and Chuck Grassley and all these guys said, no, this is the kind of health insurance reform we want to do. And they would say, Con, we're not crazy people. We understand that we need reform for our broken system. But the question is just how you do the reform. And we don't want to go the route of full socialism and a Medicare for all system, a single-payer system. So let's do this right-wing alternative where, okay, we'll subsidize it for the poor only, but then everybody else, hey, you got to go to the private market. It's a mandate that you go to the private market and, you know, you pay on a marketplace where there's direct competition on that marketplace and they're competing to give you the lowest price. So virtually the entire Republican Party supported Obamacare, but then a black Democrat comes along and says, this will be my plan. And they're like, oh, gross. Who came up with that? Government takeover of health care. They're going to kill your grandma and fuck her in the ass. What? Oh, terrible. Let's be against this. Everybody. Guys, there's this thing called the internet, and there's this thing called record keeping, where we can go back and look at what the fuck you said before Mr. Black Democrat came along. Do you not understand this? And also understand that this is why progressives, including myself, have been mad at the Democrats all along on this, on Obamacare, because we knew it was a right-wing idea. The Democrats started the negotiations by saying, all right, let's do a public option, which is you can buy in to a public health insurance system. Now, we were mad because we said you already compromised. You didn't start with your actual position, which is single payer. You already compromised. You already buckled up front. And then, you know, the Republicans said, well, let's do nothing. And then the middle ground was, okay, we're going to do the right-wing proposal of Obamacare, this, you know, individual mandate system. So we were mad at the Democrats because they buckled from the beginning, and they had already given up on our core principle from the beginning, our preferred policy. So if anybody should be ecstatic and if anybody should be happy about the way Obamacare unfolded, it's the right-wingers. And also, don't get me wrong, although I still prefer a Medicare for all system, was Obamacare better than doing nothing? Yes, because anything was better than doing nothing. Our system was beyond broken. We pay more than everybody else in the world, and we get worse health outcomes. Never mind millions of people uninsured. Never mind 45,000 people dying every year because they don't have access to basic health care. So here's just another case of Republican hypocrisy where they're not principled, man. Like, they're not arguing from, this is my ideal policy, I'm going to push for this, and then, you know, we'll have a discussion from there. everything appears to be based on emotion and obstruction. And obviously, as well, probably the biggest part is what their donors want. But this is a case where the obstruction actually overrides that other part, because the donors actually love Obamacare. The private health insurance companies want to give Obama a big wet kiss, as Jeb Bush would say, because this is exactly what they want. Now they have a monopoly on the marketplace. Everybody has to go buy, as long as you're not poor, you have to go buy from the private health insurance market. So this is one where the Republicans are shooting themselves in the foot, even with their donors, because they hate Obama that much. And as a result of that, they're also giant hypocrites, because we know they used to support these policies, and they're only against it now because Obama proposed it. So Marco Rubio trying to throw red meat out there to the conservative base to say, see, I'm like you guys. Rub some ointment on it and say a prayer and you'll be all right. That's my health care plan. When in reality, we know you used to support Obamacare just like all the rest of them, and you're a joke. All right. Do I have time for one more before we take a break? Well, I certainly can't do the article on the so-called liberal media, which is a fantastic article. Blah, blah, blah. All right, you know what? I'm going to do the minimum wage story, because I can do this one in 5 minutes. All right. Fight for 15 is a campaign to get a living wage law implemented, and they planned a one-day, 270-city protest for today. That's a lot of cities, 270 cities. So this is one full year before the 2016 election, and it's backed by various labor unions. And the movement is trying to send a message that low-income voters can stand in solidarity, and they can organize, and they can fight for political change, and they can put pressure on politicians. In fact, Bernie Sanders is joining one of these protests, I believe in the Washington, D.C. area. And overall, I mean, I love this move. These guys are 100% right in what they're fighting for. So the protests have had the largest effect so far, because they've done some of these previously. They've had the largest effect in the biggest cities, like New York and Chicago. They'll protest, and sometimes they even need to shut down the restaurants temporarily, which has made it so that the brass at these companies has to come out, and they have to say something about it, and they have to acknowledge it, and you get the sense that it really is annoying them, which is the point, which is a good thing, because then they're more likely to get to the table and have a conversation, and maybe we can get some kind of deal worked out here. But obviously the end goal isn't just to put pressure on the people at the companies, it's also to put pressure on the politicians to say, you know, we're not going to go anywhere. We're going to keep doing stuff like this unless you actually pay us a living wage, which is the most reasonable thing I've ever heard in my life. So I want to go ahead and give you some facts here to let you know how dire the situation really is, because oftentimes we overlook some of these silent heroes in the U.S. who work full-time and they don't make enough money to just pay their bills. I mean, think about that. That's a moral outrage. You work full-time, but your company doesn't pay you enough so that you can actually, you know, not worry about the lights going off or feeding your kid. And oftentimes people have no choice but to run to social safety net programs, you know, that the government provides just so that they can continue to live and scrape by as they rent themselves on the marketplace to their corporate overlords. It's a gross system, but here are some facts here. If the minimum wage had grown at the same rate as one percenter earnings, you know what it would be today? $22.62 per hour. So if minimum wage workers, if their wages grew just at the same rate as the top 1% and how much their wages have grown, isn't that amazing? $22.62 per hour. That's 212% higher than the current wage floor. Damn. If the minimum wage had kept pace with productivity gains. So this is a really interesting fact, because productivity gains means what? What you're actually getting out of your work. And this is something, you know, libertarians would often say, you can't raise the minimum wage because then you're paying people more than what they're worth. God damn it. Conservatives would say that, libertarians would say that. Well, no, the productivity gains. So if the minimum wage had kept pace with productivity gains, it would be $21.72 today. Oh, come on, man. So if these people in many circumstances were actually making what they're worth, $21.72. So if anything, they're undervalued on the marketplace. They're not overvalued, and if you raise the minimum wage, it's not going to be like you're paying them too much. They say if the minimum wage had been indexed to the consumer price index since 1968, what would it be today? So in other words, if the minimum wage in today's dollars was simply equal to what it was in 1968, what would it be when you account for inflation? $10.40. So minimum wage workers are making less today than they made in 1968. Think about that. That's totally unacceptable. And finally, I'll leave you with this. 1 in 3 U.S. families are categorized as working poor. So yet again, people can work a full-time job, not make enough money to just pay the bills, and this is the system that we have. You know, you can look at income inequality in the U.S., or you could look at income inequality worldwide, and it is a disgusting picture, and there's no logical argument for it to remain how it is. There just isn't. I'm not somebody who says, got to pay everybody exactly the same for everything. Pay the CEO exactly the same as the janitor. No, don't be ridiculous. I don't say that, and to be honest, I don't know any other liberals who say that. But all we're asking for is a sane system where, for example, you don't have 6 people in the Walton family making more money than the bottom 40% of the country. That's insane. That's insane. You can still believe in people getting rich. You can still believe in having some kind of a meritocracy-based system, but be against that, which I am. And I'm also against having people work full-time and not being able to survive and pay the bills. And every rational person should be on that page, which is why I 100% support Fight for 15. And if they keep pressing, eventually we'll get some kind of a solution and we'll get some kind of a minimum wage increase. And it's just a matter of getting to that point. The more pressure you apply, even if it feels like it's not working right now, they feel the pressure. So let's do this. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, I got a lot of great stuff to get to. I'm going to eviscerate the notion that we have a liberal media, and then we'll get into Carly Fiorina's non-tax plan. Stay right there. I'm a scat man. I'm a scat man.
I'm the professor. Western Hall, I can tell you. If I still see them, say this real weakness, those things you call dead, I never have a chance to be born. I'm the scared man.
Segment doesn't take fucking 20 minutes. We'll see. I'll try to breathe through it. There's a great article in the Washington Spectator by David Kajian eviscerating the notion that we have a liberal media. So I want to run through some of this for you. The idea is that if we had a liberal media, they certainly would cover these things much, much more. So first of all, outsourcing. Quote, since 2000, U.S. multinationals have cut 2.9 million jobs here while increasing employment overseas by 2.4 million. This is likely just the tip of the iceberg as multinational corporations account for only about 20% of the labor force. Now, of course, when you dive into the details, you find that there's NAFTA, there's CAFTA, there's GATT, there's the WTO, there's permanent normal trade relations with China. And when you take into account all these different so-called free trade deals, the net result is good-paying middle-class jobs in America being shipped everywhere but America. So if you had a liberal media, if you really did, they'd be talking about this. I can't tell you the last time I've seen, an in-depth report on outsourcing on any of the mainstream networks, even on MSNBC. The last person who would talk about it was Ed Schultz when he would discuss the TPP, and notice he's not at the network anymore. So they just don't talk about it all that much, and there's a reason why, because they're actually not a liberal media, and I'll get to what the real biases are in a little bit. So the second thing he says, income inequality. Yeah, I mean, sure, you hear a lot of talk about it here. You hear talk about it online and in new media outlets and in some print publications as well. But is the mainstream media on TV discussing income inequality? Maybe a little itty bit, but not even really that much. Quote, in 2010, the top 1% alone held 35% of all net worth. So 1% has 35% of net worth in 2010 alone. The bottom 80% of people held only 12% of net worth in the year 2010. They say in 1983, the bottom 80% held 18% of net worth. So look at that, man. Even from 1983 until today, there's been a giant chunk taken out of what the bottom 80% get, and where has it gone? To the top 1%. And then, you know, when you look at the global picture, it's even crazier. The Oxfam report that came out about a year ago, which found that the world's richest 80 people, just the richest 80 people, as they say in the original article, you could fit them on a double-decker bus. So the richest 80 people in the world, they have more wealth than the bottom 3.5 billion. That's incredible. 80 people more than 3.5 billion. That's 80 people with more wealth than 50% of the world. Okay. Even if you're a conservative, you got to look at that and go, yeah, something's off there. And again, this is something that is the mainstream media talking about this, harping away on this, making this a central issue. No, you're more likely to hear a story about the Kardashians than you are to hear about this. And you know that's true. All right, the third thing, Alec. We don't hear much about Alec. Now, every now and then something slips through the cracks. There was a story, it was a local news report that I saw maybe about 3 months ago where a guy covered Alec in pretty good detail. But it's largely absent from the national conversation in terms of on TV and the mainstream media. So, of course, that stands for the American Legislative Exchange Council. And he says, quote, if there were a corporate organization that drafted laws and then passed them on to state legislators to implement, you would think the liberal media would report on them. That's right. And they don't talk about it nearly as much as they should. And we know that they've also pushed for these so-called right-to-work laws, which in reality are right to work for less, which, you know, swing a bat at the union's kneecaps. We know that they preemptively pass vacation day bans, where they try to say, like, no, even if you in the future want to say, let's do maternity leave or paternity leave or more paid vacation days, they kneecap it at the state level. These are the kinds of things they push for. And remember, the lobbyists just hand the legislation directly to the legislators. They change like two words in there, and then they propose it. Unbelievable corruption. In-your-face corruption. Not discussed nearly as much as it should. So-called liberal media here at work. The incarceration crisis. Number four. Do they talk about this as much as they should? Quote, the U.S. has the most people in prison by far of any other country in the world. With 5% of the world's population, we have 25% of the world's prisoners. That's 2.3 million criminals. China, with a population four times ours, is second with 1.6 million people in prison. Guys, we have more people in prison in the U.S. today than Stalin did in his gulags at their height when they were the most populated they ever were. This is unbelievable. And, of course, disproportionately, these are black people or Hispanic people. These are minority communities. And the war on drugs has given a green light to oppress these communities. That's why people call this the new Jim Crow. So this is an amazing problem, and it's not spoken about nearly enough. These are real issues here. This is not a liberal media. They're not talking about these things in detail and often. How about healthcare costs? Quote, the expenditure per person in the U.S. is $8,233. Norway is second with $5,388. And our outcomes are worse than Norway. We spend way more per person for healthcare, per capita for healthcare, and they're owning us and they spend less. And they're number two. They say the total amount of GDP spent on healthcare is also the highest of any country in the world at 17.6%. The next closest country is the Netherlands at 12%. And our money's not even really going to care. Our money is going to people in a for-profit system where there are leeches who are the middlemen who are sucking us dry. Okay, where's the liberal media? Where are you? You're not talking about this enough. All right, and finally, I'll just give you two more here. But he goes on. He gives, I think, 13 examples. Glass-Steagall, he says, there's a so-called liberal media. Why are you not talking about Glass-Steagall? It separated commercial banking from investment banking and led to a steady banking system for decades. And then we got rid of it, which happened under Clinton. What happened? Not too long after that, we had the subprime mortgage crisis and the Great Recession, and you allowed commercial banks to take crazy casino capitalist bets that are obviously going to blow up in their face. So, but they don't talk about it. Go look and see how often they mention Glass-Steagall in the mainstream media. You're not going to see much of it. Gerrymandering is another one. They don't bring that up nearly as much. And, of course, this is killing the Democrats. I mean, here are the real biases of the mainstream media. It's not a liberal media bias. If you believe that, you're just brainwashed by the dumbass Republicans who just repeat it over and over, and they assert it as if that then therefore means that it's true. No, you just asserted it. You didn't provide any evidence to back it up. You just say it. It's a fucking tick that you have in your brain. It's a virus. Ah, liberal media, liberal media. But that's not true. It's not real. You don't actually provide evidence for it. So here are the real biases. By and large, and it depends which outlet you're talking about. Obviously, MSNBC is biased to the Democratic Party, not a liberal bias, not a progressive bias, but a Democratic Party bias. Fox News is biased towards the Republican establishment. But by and large, you have, whether it's CNN or the nightly news, you have a bias towards, number one, the establishment. So you don't go further to the left on the spectrum than what the Democratic Party allows you to do. So there is no real progressive voice. There is no real liberal voice. It's just a bias towards the establishment, what the two parties say. You report what they say and nothing else. A bias towards sensationalism, which is why you sprinkle in stories about reality TV stars and whatnot in the middle of actual news, and a bias towards neutrality, which means, again, the Republicans say X, the Democrats say Y, you guys decide which one is correct, let's move on to the next story. So no onus on facts or history or reality or putting things in context and having perspective and nuance and detail. Just here's what the establishment says. Let's go. Let's move along here. So those are the three real biases in the media. If it was a liberally biased media, you would hear about all the things I just laid out for you. And also, let me say this, to further increase my vulnerability. I wish that was the case, because as Stephen Colbert said, reality has a well-known liberal bias. You know, if you look at the civil rights movement, I don't think it's just a matter of opinion that MLK was right and the racist Alabama sheriffs were wrong, Bull Connor was wrong. No, I think that's just true. I don't think it's liberally biased to say, oh, that guy's the good guy and that guy's the bad guy. By the same token, to point out these policy issues, Glass-Steagall, income inequality, and how to fix that, I think that's just true. You can categorize it as liberal, but it also happens to be true. So I wish the media was like that, but clearly it's not. All right, not 20 minutes, but 10 minutes. Not bad. I try to go as fast as I could. All right, let's go to Carly Fiorina. Carly Fiorina is going to get into specifics on her non-tax plan. Let's watch.
Former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, and I asked her why she is one of just two candidates who have yet to release a detailed tax plan, or frankly, any policy plans on her website. Here's her answer.
Well, let me disagree with the premise of your question. How often do politicians put out detailed plans? How often do they get enacted? Never. That's the problem. Politicians put out detailed plans for all kinds of things. It never happens. But if you go to the CarlyForPresident.com website, what you can do is ask a question, and you will see me answering the question in public. Verbally. In other words, I am being held accountable. A plan, anybody can write a plan. Anybody can put a plan on a website. It's another thing to say, you know what I think we need to do, and say it over and over again in public and be held accountable for this. You know what I think we need to do? We need to go from a 73,000-page tax code, which is what we have today, with 4,000 changes since 2001. We need to get it down to about 3. And what that means is we need to close every loophole and lower every rate.
Well, show
maybe
us what
there
you're
are two
gonna
or three
do.
Loopholes. We've,
but how do we trust?
But that is what I'm going to do.
Well, show us.
But that
why
is what I'm going to do.
Show us your work.
So, in other words, words on a piece of paper are more accountable than words said to people looking them in the eye? I don't think so. I don't think that's what voters think. Because I think voters have gotten smart enough to know that plans and papers, 50-point plans, 10-point plans, 5-point plans, are written by a bunch of advisors and consultants. So I'm perfectly prepared to be held accountable for my words and my plans, and I would encourage your viewers to go on the website and ask any question
right.
they want.
So we shouldn't expect a tax plan out of you anytime soon on paper.
I've given you a tax plan.
No, you didn't. You just spent 2 minutes explaining why you didn't give a plan and that it's the right thing to not give a plan, and then you're like, I did give you a tax plan. No, you didn't. That whole rant you just did was about how it's the right thing to not give a tax plan. And then he's going to say, no, I gave one. Guys, this Republican Party is just, they've lost it. They've totally lost it. Carly Fiorina is quite literally arguing against policy substance. She's like, well, that doesn't matter. That shouldn't matter. Why should I have to write down my plan? Why can't I just go on different media outlets and say different things to pander to the different crowds I'm in front of? Why would you want me to actually write down exactly what I want to do and show the American people and use that as a reason for them to vote for me? Because that's what the presidency is supposed to be about. We've turned this into a joke. It's more of a reality show now than anything else. As perfect evidence of that is that a reality show star Donald Trump is leading. No, Carly, you totally missed the fucking point. Everything else is just kabuki theater and bells and whistles. When you get down to the heart of the matter, like Don Henley, it's supposed to be about the substance. That's everything. I mean, why else should somebody vote for you? What, they like your personality? They like the flip-flops that you have when you're talking to different crowds? No, you're supposed to be able to say, okay, look, here's my tax plan. I want an 18% flat rate. I want to get rid of the carry interest loophole. Whatever, I don't know. But give something, something. And then she's like, she's condescending and she's patronizing. You're talking to Chuck Todd like, well, here's what I want to do. I want to take our 73,000 page tax code and bring it down to 3. And he's like, okay, then why not put that in a plan? That's the whole purpose of the plan. She's like, no. What do you mean, no? See, Carly, we need to know exactly how you would go about doing it. Which loopholes are you going to get rid of? What specifically are you going to bring the rate down to? Which ones are you going to leave in? You said maybe keep a few loopholes. Which ones? This should be obvious. I'm at a loss for words, quite literally. It's at the point now where I now have to argue for somebody on the Republican side to tell us what they're in favor of. The whole purpose of running for president is that that's supposed to be the whole thing. Like, here's what I'm in favor of, and now you should vote for me because here are the things I'm in favor of. She's like, no, I'm just not going to tell you what I'm in favor of. Okay. www.stepasidebitch.com. What are you doing? I mean, hey, I used to be a business person. And? There are a lot of people who used to be. Herman Cain used to be a business person. Should we bring him back and vote for him? Hey, I'm a woman. Vote for me. Hillary Clinton's a woman. Why wouldn't they want to pick her over you? Hey, you know, when I'm in front of different crowds, I say different things. Vote for me. But why? Why? The argument is, trust me, the argument is the same thing Donald Trump says on his ISIS policy. We've seen that before. You know, I'm not going to tell you because maybe ISIS is watching HLN right now, and then they're going to write this down, and then they'll know what I'm going to do when I become president. So I'm not going to tell you, but vote for me. Trust me, my foreign policy is so good it'll make your head spin. I'm starting to believe that the premise of the movie Idiocracy was correct. We are now devolving, and people like Carly Fiorina and Donald Trump are proving it because they're running for president, and they say, I'm not going to tell you what I want to do, but vote for me anyway. All right, let me do one more here, then we'll take our final break. Now we'll get into some foreign policy stuff. This is pretty important. The Daily Beast is reporting that officials in the U.S. government are rooting for an ISIS-Russia war. They say, quote, 6 U.S. intelligence and military officials tell the Daily Beast that they hope an apparent ISIS attack on Metrojet Flight 9268 would force Putin to finally take the gloves off. Ever since Putin started dropping bombs on militants in Syria, officials have privately been arguing that the Russian leader committed a major strategic blunder and that his intervention in Syria would weaken both his military and his reputation and likely ignite a backlash from Islamist militants who have attacked inside Russia in the past. All right, so this is really interesting for a variety of reasons. Number one, I thought that the U.S. government was just talking about how Russia is indeed not bombing ISIS. They're bombing our rebel militants who we support. And as a result of that, you know, propaganda all day long, let's act like Russia just raised the stakes and they're pushing towards World War III and they're being provocative against the United States. That's what all the articles said 2 weeks ago. And now the people in the U.S. government are like, actually, we secretly like it and they are fighting ISIS and we want them to continue to fight ISIS. Which is it? Which is it? No, I think this shows you that what was happening beforehand was indeed propaganda. You know, I was on the verge of covering two or three different articles for the show about how Russia allegedly bombed Syrian hospitals. I had to dismiss it at the last minute because when you dug deeper and you looked at the sources are these faux human rights organizations that have names that are slightly different from actual human rights organizations that are outwardly on the side of the Syrian rebels and who are willing to twist facts in order to get the international community and America on their side to try to topple Assad. So think about this. The U.S. was just saying, oh my God, Russia, human rights atrocities in Syria, this is horrendous. And now they're like, go Russia. Fight ISIS, get more involved with ISIS, and then it's good for us. So that's point number one. Point number two is, look at the argument they use there about Russia. They say, well, I mean, Putin made a blunder by even getting involved in Syria. That's a, quote, strategic blunder. And his intervention is going to weaken both his military and his reputation and ignite a backlash from Islamic militants against him. Funny how you're able to piece all that together when it's Russia doing the intervention, and you know it's going to be bad for them in the long run. But us, they're like, no, when we go in there and we get involved, there's not going to be any downsides whatsoever. Are we creating more terrorists? No. Are we hurting our reputation around the world? No. If we go in there and we fuck up, is it cool? Totally. Isn't that amazing? That's so amazing. They're like, when Russia gets involved, they're going to fuck everything up and it's going to be bad for them. Who would get involved in the middle of a civil war in Syria? That's so stupid. You're just going to waste money and lives and all that stuff. And we're doing the same fucking thing right now. Right now. They're so amazing. Now, I tell you that story to also tell you this story. At the same time that that's happening, the International Business Times reports this, quote, Al-Qaeda chief Ayman al-Zawahiri has urged all Muslims to join the fight against Western powers and Russia. The top militant, in an audio recording that surfaced on November 1st, has said jihadists should come together in confronting the united forces in Syria. Quote, the Americans, Russians, Iranians, Alawites, and Hezbollah are coordinating their war against us. Are we not capable of stopping the fighting amongst ourselves so we can direct all our efforts against them? All right, that is only exactly what every liberal has been saying since day one. That you don't get it, you morons. The reason that they're fighting you is because you are there. If you are not there, you know what's going to happen? They're going to fight each other, and they're going to fucking kill each other. And isn't that what you want? They tell us that's what they want.
They say, we don't like the Assad regime because he's a dictator and he's a bad guy, and the Shias back him, and he's backed by Iran, so they're all bad guys. We're totally against him. He gassed his own people. Horrible, horrible people would never be on their side.
But then on the rebel side, now we know, there's al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, and ISIS, and other jihadists, and other Islamists, and we obviously don't like them either. So the perfect solution, he's telling you, the head of al-Qaeda is telling you, if you leave, we will fight each other. And what happens when they fight each other? They will kill each other. And this is only exactly what the U.S. says they want. So why are we getting involved? Guys, the answer is so clear. I mean, it hurts my head how clear it is. I mean, we're so ridiculous and we've gotten so stupid that General Petraeus actually argued we should arm moderate al-Qaeda, his words, to fight ISIS in the region. Well, why would you get us involved, and why would you have us back al-Qaeda, the fucking group that attacked us on 9/11, when we can, even according to the al-Qaeda head, stay the fuck out, and they'll take each other out. And then now with Russia involved, guys, look, somebody has to fight ISIS. I'm not a pacifist. Of course somebody's got to fight him. But just the question is, who? We've shown that when we do it, we make ourselves a target. We've been involved in war in the Middle East for well over a decade now. So the answer, quite literally or very simply, is not us. So why not allow Vladimir Putin to get involved there? The CIA operatives are right in saying that we hope that that happens. Yes, allow Vladimir Putin to get involved in there. Let him do all this stuff. Let the civil war go on. And if the U.S. actually was intelligent and rational in our priorities, we would save our money, save our soldiers' lives, and get out of the region and just go have a cocktail on the beach. But I tell you all that, and they won't do it because they've never done it. They'll continue to fuck up as they'll say that everybody else is fucking up. Whew. Let's take a break. When we come back, I got an awesome final segment for you. Obama and Netanyahu meet for the first time in a while. I'm pretty angry about that for some reasons I'll explain. And Bill O'Reilly discusses black crime. I bet you know what his argument's going to be. All right, stay right there, guys. We'll be right back.
You know, if I say something, I mean it. These things happen. Yeah.
Obama and Netanyahu met for the first time in a while, and the meeting was allegedly to smooth over their relationship. So here's what happened in it. According to the International Business Times, quote, Obama is predicted to increase the 10-year, $30 billion aid package that was agreed to in 2007 under the Bush administration. While the White House has been coy about the expected terms of the deal, Israel is requesting that the U.S. increase its financial commitment by half from $3 billion a year to around $4.5 billion. So we're going to give Israel and we're going to give Netanyahu more money, more weapons, more defense systems. So what does Obama think that he'll get out of this? Well, first of all, Netanyahu's silence on the Iran deal is a big part of this, which I find hilarious because he literally didn't get that. Netanyahu already came here when we were in the heated process of trying to get it through and gave this speech about how you should totally be against it. So he came to Congress, this is unprecedented, without the approval of the White House or anything, he came to Congress to give the speech, and now Obama's like, okay, I'll give you more weapons and more money if you are silent on it. But he already wasn't silent on it, so why would you do that? If anything, shouldn't you punish him now because he didn't do that? But no, this is the way Obama thinks about this. Is just give them more, give them more, give them more. He actually offered at another time to increase weapons and aid there, and Netanyahu was like, shh, not too soon. I can't let it look like you bought my silence on the Iran deal, so I'm going to be against it now, and then later on, after I've already fought against it, then you can still give me weapons and money, even though I did the opposite of what you wanted me to do. So there's that. And also, Obama likely believes that to do this would also get a promise from Netanyahu that there's no more settlement building under his administration. Well, let me read you two quotes from Netanyahu here, and you tell me if you think this will work. He said in 2001, quote, "I know what America is. America is a thing that can be easily moved in the right direction. They will not bother us. Let's suppose they will say something." So they say it. We have such support there. So in other words, you gotta just play the Americans right, and we can get away with whatever we want to get away with. Now, that was 2001. Fast forward a little bit here. 2014, quote, "When I entered the Prime Minister's office for my second term, I was summoned to Washington. Not one brick, they told me. The pressure from the international community and the Americans was enormous. And still, after 5 years on the job, we built a little more than one brick. The important thing is to do it in a smart way, to stand up to international pressure by maneuvering. We continue to head straight towards our goal, even if one time we walk right and another time we walk left." So, in other words, yeah, I'm going to continue to build the settlements, and I will play the international community and the Americans every step of the way and pretend at times like I'm for a Palestinian state, I'm for a peace deal, but nonetheless, I'm going to continue to build the settlements. Now, if you think, well, Kyle, you're just reading too much between the lines there, well, first of all, you're naive as fuck, because I just gave you his quotes, and if you don't think that's implied in what he's saying, then you're dense. You know, you're trying to pretend like that's not the case when it is the case. But fast forward to this week, and we learn this. Quote from Vice News. "Hours before Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited Washington, D.C. to meet with President Barack Obama on Monday, press reports in Israel revealed that the government had approved the construction of 2,200 new settlement units in the occupied West Bank." He just slapped Obama across the face. He's got him by the balls. Look, Netanyahu is using this Iran deal to throw a tantrum, throw a fit. "So I'm against it, and you're putting us in danger more, so this is a problem, and now you're going to give me everything I want. You're going to give me money, you're going to give me weapons, you're going to shut the fuck up, and I'm going to build more settlements, and you're not going to say dick about it." That's what he's doing here. He's using the Iran deal for that. And President Obama said, "Oh, okay. All right, you win. You get it." When in reality, what should Obama be saying? I made Israel more safe with the Iran deal. If anything, I shouldn't be giving you shit. You should be giving me shit. I saved your ass by doing this deal. Don't buy into the Republican bullshit when they say, oh, they're going to create a nuke now. The whole point of the deal is for them not to create a nuke. And we have the IAEA doing regular inspections, and that's what we got. The deal was a success on that front. But that's the thing. I say, you know, don't listen to the Republicans, as if Netanyahu effectively isn't a Republican. He's in the Likud party, which is a right-wing party in Israel. And, of course, he believes what the Republicans believe. So he just slapped you across the fucking face, Obama. You know what? We got to stop this. I mean, he's playing you for a fucking fool. The United States should lift our veto at the UN on the issue of a Palestinian state. And we should cut all of Israel's aid, the billions of dollars we give them every year, and tell them, you want our support? It's conditional. Not only are you not going to build any more settlements, you're going to do a two-state deal right now. And, oh yeah, guess what? This isn't all we're doing. If you refuse, not only are we going to lift the veto and cut your aid, we also are going to get together and do sanctions on you. There's going to be sanctions on you. And all this goes away. It all goes away. You know, we'll be best buddies forever if you just do the two-state. Enough fucking around. But is Obama going to do that? I think you know the answer to that. All right, now, go to Rush Limbaugh and his fragile, brittle self. He's having trouble getting out the word brittle.
It's a good word. I should use that more often. So Rush Limbaugh is going to brag about himself while protecting Ben Carson here in another sad display of self-aggrandizement. Rush, take it away.
Former South Carolina State Representative Lakari Sellers, a Democrat, is on, and they're discussing Ben Carson's campaign. And this Lakari Sellers guy, who is a former South Carolina Democrat representative, says...
Everybody has read Gifted Hands or watched the movie with Cuba Gooding Jr. I mean, it's inspiring. When I travel around and speak, I tell kids, you know, to be a lawyer like Thurgood Marshall or be a scientist like George Washington Carver or a doctor like Ben Carson. I mean, that's what I'd say because it was that inspirational. Now I can't tell if he's Rush Limbaugh.
See, he was going along just fine until he got to get all conservative on everybody. He had to get all religious. Now I can't tell if a guy's Rush Limbaugh. Let me tell you something. That is a profound compliment. Somebody thinks Ben Carson's starting to sound like me, he's going to go places. But see, these Democrats, what they think is, the mention of my name causes immediate disapproval for the person they associate with. This Democrat guy, this Bakari Sellers. So he's on CNN. And they've got to take Ben Carson out. They've got focus group in polling day that says Democrats hate me. So associating Ben Carson with me, that discredits Carson. That's why they do that. They don't understand that this is a multifaceted compliment.
His ego is so fragile and so brittle and just so thin, as paper thin, that ego. And also, he secretly loves it whenever anybody in any mainstream outlet mentions him. Because he's a mess. His show's a mess. I love how... So I was giving specific ratings numbers recently, and I got somebody on Twitter was like, oh, yeah? Well, he's number one. Look at the list. They sent me the Nielsen ratings. First of all, Nielsen has 8,000 problems with how they do their ratings. But second of all, he's number one in talk radio. That's like being the tallest kid in kindergarten. That's like being the smartest person in a Republican debate. Doesn't mean anything. Because that gets blown out of the water by everything else. AM radio has no listeners. It's all people who are over 65. You know, any... actual music, for example, on FM destroys. And remember, advertisers fled from his show long ago. He had dead air on his flagship station in New York before he actually lost his deal with this flagship station. Now he's at the second biggest station. But he had dead air with that station because all the advertisers were running away from him. So where does he get his money from? He gets his money from the right-wing think tanks who prop him up, whether it's the Heritage Foundation or the American Enterprise Institute or the rest of them. So he's actually, ironically, a welfare case. He can't make it in the free market anymore. All the advertisers ran. So who's propping him up? Again, the right-wing think tanks. So, again, this is projection. He's usually guilty of what he's accusing others of being guilty of. So when he talks about, yeah, Democrats and the others, hell, they're lazy parasite moochers. They can't make it in a free market. You can't make it in a free market. And look at him. Again, that ego, man. Every show now, Rush has to talk about himself in this way to pump himself up because nobody else is doing it. And he's saying, well, it's good that people are comparing Carson to me because that means Carson's going places. Carson's well past his prime. When he was doing the neurosurgery, that was his prime. Now he's just an utter joke. And no, Rush, it's not the case that – he's like, but Democrats think I'm a clown, but I'm not, I swear. Yes, you are. You absolutely are. But what's crazy is that it's been proven that the more lies Carson has been telling, the better his poll numbers get. That tells you something about the Republican base here. So let me run through some of these lies for you. Carson said that he got a full scholarship to West Point, and not only did he not, West Point doesn't even have scholarships. If you get in, it's free for everybody. What a loser. Dude, how do you not, like, watch yourself before you say something so utterly made up? He told stories about his violent past. In fact, I referenced them on the show previously. It turns out all of them were made up. He said he tried to stab his mom and shit. There was an investigation, I think it was Politico, looked into his background. They're like, we found no evidence of any of these stories that he told. And he gave details and specifics about at school, and I tried to stab this guy, and I was a wild man. They're all like, no, that's not the case at all. There isn't even a person. One of them, he made up some names, and they were like, was there a Jerry or something? And they're like, no, there wasn't even a Jerry in the whole school. Oh, my God, Ben, why are you lying? And why that? If there was ever something to not lie about, why would you lie about that? You know, I was so violent that that's going to make you get more votes in a Republican primary. Apparently it does. Apparently they think, oh, yeah, oh, he was like those other blacks, violent when he was younger, but then he found Jesus, and now he's a neurosurgeon, and he found conservatism, and now he's great. He said God saved him in a car accident. God helped him pass a test when he didn't study. And he said he had no relation with the supplement company, when not only did he have a relationship with them, he argued that the products from that company helped cure his cancer. And my personal favorite, at Yale, he had to take final exams. And somehow the final exams got burned. They were destroyed in a fire. This is already so tremendously made up. And so the teacher said, all right, you guys have to take the test again. And everybody else in the class said no. He was the only one who said yes. And he said the class was called Perceptions 301. He's using this as a story. He's like, I was such a leader, I was the only one who took the exam. Okay, everything about that is made up. Everything. There isn't even a class called Perceptions 301. The entire story is bogus. And again, as these stories break, poll numbers go up. In Iowa, in New Hampshire, and nationally. In fact, he's tied with Donald Trump now. So a reality show star with a meerkat on his head leading, and a proven liar who is human Xanax, because he's basically asleep all the time, is leading. They're tied for the lead. I give you the Republican Party. All right, now, move on to Bill O'Reilly here, and I got three left. I should be able to get all these in, but you never know. Bill O'Reilly is covering the death of a 9-year-old boy from gang violence. So let's listen to his conversation here and see if you can spot the glaring flaw in his reporting.
Now, I've called for Chicago and the mayor of Chicago and the governor of Illinois to put the National Guard in these areas just for a while, just to stop the daily carnage. Would you support that, Mr. Ward?
No, I wouldn't. I would support that because, Bill, this situation right here, we all know this is by design. All I want to know is one thing. Chicago and other areas of Chicago, it's not happening. Only on the south side, Englewood, Auburn, Garden, areas like that. Why is it not happening in the other areas where it's predominantly white folks at?
Because the drug trade and the drug trafficking where these gangs are making their profits, that is centered in this neighborhood. You were a gang member at one time. The father of this 9-year-old boy, and this is what we understand happened, is a gang member, all right? And the other gang that didn't like him shot his 9-year-old son to bring pain to him. I mean, this is barbaric behavior, Mr. Ward. This is something out of ISIS.
It seems to be obviously gang-related, and I think it is time for the National Guard. I have written that, as you know, Mr. O'Reilly, and every time I write it, I get attacked to say, oh, you don't want to do that. We are in a state of emergency, and I think you do want to do that on a temporary basis.
That's
to stabilize these communities.
And protect the poor law-abiding people who are being held hostage.
They're being held hostage. People are living in fear. People are scared. They're scared to let their children go to school. It's kind of you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And these kids are getting killed in daily, normal, routine activities, going to your grandmother's house, coming from your grandmother's house, standing in front of your school, riding the bus, in the playground. The kids are doing what they should do as kids. But this gang thing, where does it come from? I don't know where it comes from.
And a culture that is sociopathic.
All right, so just to the idea that he's covering this story, good thing. Everybody in the mainstream media should cover the story of a 9-year-old boy getting shot and killed in the United States of America, for sure. But everything else about the way he covers it, it shows you why he's doing it. And his motivation for doing it ain't good. So what I mean by that is, look at what he threw in there at the end. He said, well, the problem in Chicago and in these black communities is that it's the culture. It's a sociopathic culture. And Bill, our whole beef with you, the reason why the left dislikes you so much, is that when you say shit like that, you're not giving it proper context and perspective. And the implication is there that it's because of who they are. It's that culture that's sociopathic, and you fix the culture, and everything else is great. Which is why his solution, as you heard, is what? Send in the National Guard. No, Bill, that's not the answer. The answer is, and you almost alluded to it, you were flirting with being right, but then of course you weren't in the end. You said it was, well, the drug trade and drug trafficking is leading to this violence. Right, so what's the solution? Number one, end the drug war. Number two, do federal gun reform, because while Chicago has tight gun laws, in the areas around it, they don't. You can just go out and get it and then bring it back into Chicago. Do gun reform throughout the country. That'll help the situation. Then number three, you do public investment into downtrodden communities across the U.S. And you do number four, private investment. You incentivize private investment in places like Detroit and Chicago and elsewhere. That's how you fix the problem. But see, that's really why Bill O'Reilly's covering the story, is because of that last part, which is what he wants to emphasize, which is, you know how those blacks are. That's how they are. Blame them. It's the, quote, sociopathic culture. No, the real conversation, Bill, is in what happens before that to lead to all of the gang violence and to lead to all the violence and all of the problems. And the answer to that is extreme poverty, lack of opportunity, and the fact that drugs are fucking illegal. When we had prohibition in the country, you know what happened? The mafia got very, very powerful. Because you gave them a monopoly on the marketplace. So the criminals are the ones who are going to get all the money, and there's going to be a spike in crime. Because if there's some sort of dispute underground on the black market, you can't go to court and wear suits and ties. You have to take out the Tommy gun and shoot people in the face. So there was a spike in crime when there was prohibition. Fast forward to today with the drug war. What's going to happen when drugs are illegal, so the criminals, by definition, are the ones who are selling the drugs and around the drugs and getting rich off the drugs? Naturally, you're going to have turf wars. You're going to have gang wars. People are going to die. And it's not because of the blacks and how they are. It's because of the political circumstance that there is on the ground. The extreme poverty, the lack of opportunity. Naturally, people are going to go into that area because it's the only area where they can make any money. And you're not attacking the core of the problem, which is, again, ending the drug war, doing federal gun reform, and doing public investment and private investment in these communities to give them a shot. See, it's not the case that blacks are just different from whites, and that's why this is happening, and it's the sociopathic culture. No, the problem is the extreme poverty. The problem is the lack of opportunity. The problem is the drug war. If you legalize, tax, and regulate drugs, people won't be shooting each other when there's a dispute. You'll have people who are no different than the CEO of Budweiser, who can be living in these different communities in Chicago and elsewhere. And this is the main point. You have to focus on these issues because if you implement this systemic reform and this change, well then, you know, you give these communities a shot. And a guy like Bill O'Reilly, his main purpose is to point at the individuals who are the victims of all this and say, well, it's that sociopathic culture that's the problem. So if I bark at them, I'll be making it better by trying to get them to change their actions. All right, next. I got two more, and one of them involves Fox and Friends looking at half-naked women. That's fun. I'll save that for last. Vice News has some interesting reporting on the overregulation in China, and it really highlights out-and-out social authoritarianism. So they say the following, quote, the Ministry of Culture has announced that from January 1st next year, every song released by a Chinese download or stream service is to be reviewed and censored if deemed inappropriate. All songs that have, quote, poor taste and vulgar content will be banned. Now, you want to talk about government that is far too big and way too involved in your personal life, I think we found it. So to give you some examples, this includes Katy Perry's song Last Friday Night. And the reason is it alludes to threesomes. It includes six songs from Lady Gaga's album Born This Way, plus Simple Plan's You Suck at Love, which features the phrase awesome fuck. That's too much. Censor it. Ban it. All content, they say, quote, all content that promotes sex, violence, or crime, or harms public morality, is banned. All right, that's adorable, because right there, all entertainment in the U.S., gone. I mean, think about it. Sex, violence, or crime, I mean, Scarface, gone. Goodfellas, gone. These are classics that we're talking about here. Titanic, there's sex in Titanic, gone. Violence, virtually everything is violent. Fucking Rambo, Rocky, anything. All of Hollywood, dismissed. You know, you could even stretch it to just using, I guess, bad language. That might count as well. Must go away. Me? Actually, it's funny because there was somebody who listened to the show who told me when it happened that, oh, congratulations, you got on the banned list in China. Now I have to, you know, get your show via whatever they have to do on their computer in order to get it. But I got on the banned list in China. Isn't that amazing, man? They get involved in everything, No. When it comes to social freedoms, kind of like when Chris Christie used the term civil liberties extremist, and we laughed at him and we mocked him. Yeah, because it's not like there's a middle ground. Either you believe in civil liberties or you don't. Well, it's the same thing with this, with social freedoms. Do you believe in them or do you not believe in them? Here we have the Chinese government saying clearly, of course we don't believe in them. Anything violent, any porn, gone. Guys, living without porn is only going to make people way more violent, way more more violent. There's a reason why art gets a pass. It ain't real. So when I play a first-person shooter video game, I don't wake up the next day going, I have an insatiable bloodlust. I must shoot people in the face. No, I eat a sandwich and I go about my day. There's no connection. Any connection you're making up, it's the same as when people say porn will lead to an increase in sex crimes. But it doesn't. If anything, the evidence says the opposite. They say authorities are also cracking down on sites that offer porn and gambling. We crack down on gambling as well in the U.S., so we have something in common there for sure. And earlier this month, media outlets across the country were reminded that they exist to promote the Communist Party and will be reprimanded for failing to adhere to this vision. That's so sad. They've taken what the purpose of media is and flipped it. They're like, being adversarial to the government to try to implement change and represent the people and give people facts and data about what their government is doing in their name. Like, no, you're just a propaganda arm. And if you don't do that, we're going to crack down on you. Great. Well, you letting us know you're a tyranny. And finally, I'll leave you with this. A Chinese dissenter complained about this online, and he made a really good point. He said, quote, why doesn't the Ministry of Culture go and regulate food and drugs? And, of course, he's alluding to the fact, like, there was the rat meat scandal recently in China, which is, like, they were selling rat meat as if it was other meat. He's like, where the fuck was your regulation there, bitch? We needed it there. We need you to regulate and do your job to protect us from fucked up drugs and bad food. But China does the opposite. They're like, well, that area, we're not gonna regulate at all. You know, you get what you get. Oop, you ate a rat. Whatevs, dude. But everything in your personal life, porn, movies, video games, oh, no, we got to crack down. Be surprised when your population is really pissed off at you and they revolt, because it's going to happen eventually. All right, and finally, Fox and Friends. The family values people over at Fox and Friends decided to do a segment on Victoria's Secret models where they show them half naked.
33 minutes after the hour, it's your shot of the morning and a behind-the-scenes look at what it takes to become a Victoria's Secret angel.
Finally.
What are you doing on November 9th and 10th?
I don't know.
Why don't you come join us?
It's like a miracle.
Oh,
it's unbelievable. Get over here with your bikini on.
Oh, it's giving us
all that. Gigi Hadid, overwhelmed to earn her angel wings for the Victoria's Secret fashion show. Until this moment, we thought that was all going to be behind closed doors. Casting directors considered more than 500 models from all over the world to walk the runway, but only 44 made the final cut.
Oh, and the live event is tonight in New York City, but it doesn't air on television until December the 8th.
So in other words, New Yorkers have a choice. Do they want to go to the live show or watch the
debate?
I'd watch the debate. Watch
the debate. Hey, this doesn't air until
we've never talked about this before. We have had a chance to meet the Victoria's Secret models in all different types, all different venues.
They all come by.
They are wonderful people with marvelous personalities. And when they show up, they don't just sit there and say, look at me, I'm pretty. They talk back.
That's
what's
right. But
point?
You also, without mind, just turn the volume down. I mean, they're sitting there crying and squealing. And normally men are like, oh, that is so awful, women, when they do that. But then,
a lot of times I wrestle in good conversation with supermodels. But now tell me about the Victoria's Secret models. They're very conversant.
You just had that formal history because we had a supermodel on and Brian had read somewhere that she didn't have a belly button. He said, I hear you don't have a belly button. And she said, I have a belly button? What are you talking about? But that's fine. It was viral for about a year. Turns out she didn't have a belly button. She didn't want to admit it. And everybody knew she didn't have a belly button.
Now you're calling one of the
idiots
that are great a liar.
Let's talk about women's body parts some more. This is a great conversation. I really enjoyed how Kilmeade was like, you know, models are usually kind of off in the head and a little stupid, and you can't talk to them. You can't connect with them. Brian, that's you. You just described yourself. In fact, the original models who he talked to, who he said he couldn't connect with, that was likely because they were way smarter than you. That's what I see there. You're describing Fox and Friends hosts. Or just Fox hosts generally when you say that. And, I mean, I can't get over the hypocrisy. We see this all the time. O'Reilly does it. Hannity does it. Oh, we're pro-family on this network. We care about moral values and social conservatism. Anyway, did you guys see her tits? They're nice, right? Throw them up on screen again. Put that on a loop for me. It's like when Hannity does the spring break revealed. He's like, can you believe the debauchery going on? Let's show this one more time. There a woman is feeling herself as beer gets poured on her, and now she's twerking. Oh, this is so outrageous. Put that in slow motion for me, please. It's never been more clear. It is 100% fake outrage, and virtually anybody at this point can see through it. All right, guys, I love you. We'll see you tomorrow, baby. I'll be live tweeting the GOP debate tonight. Mwah.